Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, I'm joined by hosts of the wonderful RetroTube podcast, Adam Leslie and Heather Wainwright. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello. I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Yeah, this is the Beatles podcast equivalent of being invited onto Wogan.
I can't remember what I said last time. Just so you know, listeners, we had to redo this because I forgot to press record. And we're trying to simulate the entire conversation we had before.
We're trying to recreate the spontaneous bonhomie of the original introduction.
That's exactly what we're doing here.
It's more Bon Jovi.
More Bongella.
We really are living on a prayer.
So what are your thoughts of Get Back? Did it exceed your expectations?
I think it did. I mean, it's difficult to know. It's such a huge sensory overload. It's nearly 8 hours of just solid Beatles. And I've been a Beatles fan since I was six or seven. And growing up in the 80s, it was quite a task to try and actually see the Beatles in motion, actually film of the Beatles. Because the stock, obviously, in the 80s, the stock was quite low of the Beatles. So I had plenty of picture books and all the album covers I could study. But actually seeing the Beatles and even just clips of them performing in the music videos on TV, you'd hardly see them. So occasionally, late at night, you'd see Hey Jude, the David Frost one, or the Strawberry Fields Forever promo. And that was so magical, just a three-minute glimpse of the Beatles actually moving and in motion.
Yes.
So I was watching it transport myself back to my 11-year-old self, and how mind-blowing it would be for that little chap. But even for a grown-up me, it was very exciting.
How about you, Heather?
Yeah, I don't have the same connection with the Beatles, I guess. Mainly because I'm an awkward sod. And I've been obsessed with the 1960s as a complete thing, like, you know, the music world, the television world, the fashion world, etc., 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 since I was probably about the same age that Adam got into the Beatles. Because, obviously, I don't know if anybody can pick this up, but I am a scouser. Because I'm into the 60s and because I'm from Liverpool, everybody kind of seems to instantly assume, oh, well, you'll be a massive fan of the Beatles then. And because, I don't know if it's because I'm a George Harrison fan, but but because of this, I'm like, oh, yeah? Yeah, well, actually, I can't be bothered with them. But I'm the only person who's allowed to say that. Because if anybody else says anything remotely against the Beatles, I'm like, well, sit down here, son, and listen to me. I was kind of avoiding Get Back because it felt like it was going to be 8 hours of Paul saying, why don't you try playing this in F sharp? Which, to be fair, episode one was. But no, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed what I've seen a lot more than I expected to. It was good. And it's always good fun to be in a room with the Beatles, isn't it? I mean, you can't not have a good time when you're with them. They're always like, it's like not having seen some really good friends for a long time and then all of a sudden just all meeting up and having like a drink and a chat and a giggle over stuff. And it's nice to watch things where I can actually understand what's being said.
So we're going in. It's Tuesday the 21st of January. It's day 12. And despite the fact that the TV special has been cancelled, filming's continuing in the basement of 3 Savile Row. Everyone's now agreed all the footage is going to be used for the Beatles' next feature film and that the album's going to be recorded live with no overdubs. So that's obviously adding to the pressure. Glyn Johns is booked to do another session in LA and only has a few days left to work on Get Back. The previous day, they were at Savile Row, and that was the first rehearsal with George back in the band, and understandably the Beatles hadn't allowed the film crew in. Today, they've had the rehearsal, first rehearsal with George, and we're there. So it starts with the piano being tuned, so the equipment's still not quite ready, and Ringo arrives in what I can only describe as the best shirt in the world.
It is.
Oh, I would wear that shirt.
That was my first thought when I saw it. I was like, oh, Adam S. Leslie will be all over that.
I really would. I love a good shirt.
You do love a good shirt.
I always had it
in my mind.
There's
a lot of good shirts in this, aren't there?
Aren't there? Yeah. This wasn't the day that had the ultimate clothing collection, but it's still pretty corking. I really like Ringo's green suit that he wears on one of the days. I think that might be my top pick for the Beatles outfits.
Ringo knew how to wear stuff, didn't he?
He did. And I think I always had it in my mind that after 1967, once you get into 1968, all the colourful psychedelic clothes stop and they're just wearing jeans and T-shirts and trainers and waistcoats, which is largely true for John and Paul, I think. But it's nice to see that George and Ringo were keeping the colourful thing going.
They really were. And obviously Glyn Johns, a lot of people have been talking about. My favourite description from Bob Fisher is his Mod Womble coat, which I love.
Yes, yes. I think Glyn Johns is possibly, potentially, I don't know, I've not made an in-depth investigation, but I think he's actually the nicest man in the whole wide world.
Oh, have you met him?
No.
Oh, okay.
I've not done a lot of investigation, but I just think he might well be. He seems terrified of smoking a cigarette, although he seems to do nothing else. Because, like, he hardly holds it. It's like he couldn't hold it between his fingertips more loosely if he tried. But yet, he valiantly presses on.
So we also see that the two smallest women I've ever seen bringing in tea. They're tiny.
Or maybe they're very big cups.
Yes.
My theory is that because
the poor little trees trembling under the weight of it.
My theory is that the small faces broke up on New Year's Eve, so only a few days before this. So I think they've escaped. They've been cast adrift from the small faces entourage. Because I imagine the small faces entourage is only made up of really tiny people. So I think these two ladies have just become dislodged.
Is that the right word?
Yeah, something like that.
They're wandering around Savile Row with like signs around them saying, please look after these two ladies.
So Martin, I keep calling him Martin Luther King. Michael Lindsay Hogg.
I keep on calling him Jacob Rees-Mogg. So, you know, between us we'll get his name.
MLH. So he and Ringo are having a little chat as they come in. And he's saying, you know, in retrospect, I'm really glad we got out of Twickenham. He didn't enjoy it. And they both agree that it's far too big for them. And again, Michael Lindsay Hogg, to punctuate his stories, he always takes a puff from his massive cigar.
He might be a nice chap in person, but he seems so oily. He's like, he looks like a 12-year-old who's smoking cigars.
He does.
Obviously, it's a name, if you read lots of Beatles books, it's a name I've been familiar with for years. I would imagine him being 40, 45, something like that, a proper, you know, old school American movie director coming over. And he's just this young punk who's barely out of short trousers, puffing away on these big obnoxious cigars of his and just being a little bit slimy seeming. I don't know how old he is here.
He's 28.
Is he 28? Blimey, he's got some good genes.
Yeah.
Or a really effective moisturiser.
When they move from Twickenham to Savile Row, Michael Lindsay Hogg, his power has suddenly been... He's now in their territory, isn't he? He's not quite as vocal or as bolshy at least.
That's true, yes. He's not in a film studio anymore now. He's in a recording studio.
Yeah.
George Martin makes a point as well. When the dwarves deliver the tea... The four of them are standing under a boom mic. George is saying, we'll be getting rid of this, won't we? No, it's to it's to record, was it, unobserved conversation?
Yes. Yeah, but George, when he says this is for intimate, unobserved conversation, and Mal just, like, laughs in his face, George Martin looks at him like, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't stuttering there, I wasn't making a request. You're going to take these flipping microphones out of here while I'm recording my album? God damn! Sit down, kid.
I think whenever George Martin's on screen, it always feels like a bit of an exhale. Ah, George Martin's here. Everything's going to be all right. He's just such a reassuring presence.
He is.
He's like Tom Bosley in Happy Days.
Yes. Doesn't look very similar, but I know what you mean. I had him down as being like Gandalf. Well,
he told Michael Lindsay Hogg, you shall not pass.
Yes. Just whenever the adventure starts.
Shall not pass Tripoli. Yeah.
Whenever the adventure starts to get really fraught, then he's there just to dispense wisdom, and he knows exactly. It's great watching him, particularly, like, he knows exactly where to set up speakers and microphones, and it's all, you know, he doesn't even really appear to think about stuff. He just has this intuitive insight into where things should be positioned and how everything should be set up. And I always had this idea that he left the White Album, right, screw you guys, tipped over the table. And then he came back for Abbey Road. They said, please, George. And he said, all right, I'll come back for Abbey Road. And if I'll produce what you want me to produce, or I won't produce at all. But no, apparently he was there the whole time. And he's very, very professional in the fact that he is working with Glyn John, the producer, and he doesn't seem resentful of that, which I like. He's just like,
he's encouraging him, if anything, isn't he? He's like,
which is really nice. He doesn't seem to have that monstrous ego that a lot of these music types would have. He seems very, very professional.
Yeah. Good old George. So the previous day, which we didn't get to see, but it's obviously gone really well, and Ringo was saying, you know, they kept going till about 20 past seven. Mal Evans was saying it could have gone even longer, which is good to know. Then George arrives, George Harrison. So this is the first time we've seen him at a rehearsal since he walked out. And he confirms that. He's saying, yeah, it's good vibes, man. Mm. Then Glyn arrives, John and Yoko, and John is still wearing his continuity fur coat, which he's decided to wear. And I love that. He's decided from day one, I'm going to wear this fur coat. So you're going to look like you're changing clothes every 20
yes.
minutes. But it must have a bit of a hoi to it by now.
I love how they all say good morning to each other every morning. That's really sweet. Again, you don't really imagine that. Like, Led Zeppelin say good morning to... Good morning, Robert. Yo. Morning, John Paul, or whatever his name is. But they're so polite.
So Ringo, and I love stuff like this. Ringo's talking about he'd been watching Around the Beatles the other night, because Glyn Johns did the sound for that, and he's complimenting on that. But I love stuff like that, where they're self-referential. The Beatles talking about the Beatles.
And there's so much of it, isn't it? They're always talking about their own past, which is a big eye-opener, I think.
Oh, and then Mal's assistant, Kevin Harrington.
Ginger hero.
Brings along two mugs of... Yeah. What are your thoughts on him?
Go on, Heather, I didn't have any.
Oh, is that the one who I thought was you?
Yes, even though he's very muscular and well-built and I'm not.
but you know how to carry a brew.
Just anyone with ginger hair, we all look the same, apparently.
Yeah, it's true. All of you. It's really difficult. I hope you're never in a lineup together.
I've genuinely been mistaken for Ed Sheeran, even though he's 16 years younger than me and looks nothing like me. I'm old enough to be his dad.
How dare you? How dare you come into my dance space and accuse me of being Ed Sheeran?
Good day, sir.
Oh dear.
Kevin's arrived with two mugs of coffee and he looks utterly miserable. I think it's just because it's first thing in the morning and he's probably thinking, oh, all I do is this.
I wonder if maybe he's he knows his place. He is essentially the apprentice. He's the young lad at the very bottom of the ladder. He's maybe just being a bit meek as well, possibly, I think.
I think so.
He's just really paranoid about not, you know, spilling coffee on a load of musical equipment while they're trying to record an album because, you know, clumsiness is definitely a thing.
Especially with ginger people.
It is. And then there's a lovely little moment, which I don't think I've ever seen happen before, where Yoko's talking to George Martin about where she can get some classical scores.
Yes.
And I've never seen Yoko and George Martin speaking to each other, certainly in the Beatles era.
No, I don't think so. And she's very polite as well.
I loved Yoko in this. I thought she was great. But because obviously of all of the, you know, all of the people being what's-her-name, and saying that it was her who broke up the Beatles, when clearly she just, like, sat there minding her own business for the entire recording. I've made a lot of Yoko Ono breaking up the Beatles notes. So first of all, Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles by getting a slice of toast, and then she broke up the Beatles by asking George where she can buy sheet music from. Her plans are so sinister.
It was inevitable after that.
She's just so insidious, the way she wheedles in there, gets a toast.
With her beautiful calligraphy.
Knitting. Dare she? Dare she?
Slyly.
I think she sews at some point as well.
Slyly chatting pleasantly to Linda. How dare she?
Yeah, that was right. Honestly, the audacity of the woman.
So at this point, there's discussions, and they're still continuing to talk about an outdoor performance to end the movie. And George, I mean... During the meeting that they had around Ringo's house, I think, reading between the lines and from what's been written, that one of his reasons he'd agreed to come back was that they weren't going to do this show. So his face, when Michael Lindsay-Hogg suggests doing this, he's not happy. And of course, time's running out because Glyn Johns is booked to go to LA.
And Ringo's booked for Capers.
Well, yeah. Then we see Michael Halsko's Daily Sketch article And this is surreal. This is like meta.
Isn't it? Beyond
the end of a beautiful friendship argument. And George is pretty annoyed about it because it claims punches were thrown between him and John Lennon.
Yeah. But the Beatles have this reputation, I think, just because they are the most famous of all rock bands, of being quite a fighty band. But they didn't have actual physical altercations at all, apart from, except for a plate of dinner in Hamburg, according to John, which makes them sound like Dickensian urchins, really, doesn't it? The only time they came to blows was over a plate of dinner in Hamburg.
Yeah. A jug of broth was thrown.
I heard it like, you know, John threw a plate of food at George.
Oh, maybe.
I didn't realise it was like an actual fight over who got the last roast potato or anything.
Please, John, can I have some more?
No, you can't.
So a lot of the bad, like the Monkees punched each other, the Kinks were always fighting.
Kinks did nothing but fight.
The Who as well, blimey.
But the Beatles didn't come to blows at all. You know about 60s bands more than I do, Heather. Who do you think was the most fightiest of all bands?
Oh, the Who.
Really? Even more than the Kinks?
Yeah,
defo. Roger Daltrey got kicked out of the band for like 5 days in about 1964 because he flushed Keith Moon's speed down the toilet. And Keith hit him with a cymbal.
Oof.
And blood was drawn. It was like, it was a really nasty fight. And John and Pete took Keith's side and so kicked Roger out of the band for a couple of days. And that was like one of the little fights.
Mick Avery hit Dave Davis with a cymbal once as well. So it's a thing for drummers to nearly kill band members with their cymbals.
Yeah, but it's a lead singer and a lead guitarist, so, you know, fair.
Yes.
As far as we know, Ringo never killed him.
No.
Ringo would never.
He wouldn't.
He's all about the peace and love.
Yeah, it was one of the notes I made actually about John Lennon is how happy and smiley and funny he is. Again, contrary to the reputation they have, anyone who's listened to RetroTube, I think it's come out a couple of times, one of my bugbears is John's portrayal in films, you know, hey, Epi, come on, Epi, that really confrontational, snarling, perpetually angry Lennon, who's just always glowering in the corner and spitting these demands and challenges at people. Either that or the meme John, who's this beatific character with his long Jesus hair and his thick glasses, looking very serene, and then the quotes next to him, of him saying something wise, usually something he didn't actually say. And the real John's nothing like that at all. He's very silly.
He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy.
Exactly.
But it is, because it was always portrayed that way after books back in the day. You knew that he was pretty well out of his box throughout 67. From 68, he was this really angry man, and then he became a hippie. But you can see all of that in here, primarily 64 Beatlemania era funny John. People don't change.
No, exactly.
That much.
And I'm sure he could be, particularly when he'd had a couple down him, he could get very unpleasant. But it does seem like largely he was just there. He was just very entertaining, a bit hyperactive. Just like his mind is always on the go, and he's always thinking up funny things to say and just larking about to make people amused and happy. And his one, but like the laugh out loud moments in the film mostly coming from John and all his antics.
Yeah, so George is reading the article out. He's basically saying it's a lie. It's a complete lie. There's nothing to it. And John says, well, I hope it doesn't come out about me beating up Maharishi. And I love the bit because Beatles press officer Derek Taylor comes in. But they're sort of saying, well, Derek will have sorted it out.
John calls him Dennis, doesn't he, I think?
Yeah. Morning, Dennis. John says, do you think it's suable? No. What about the fistcuffs? Yeah, none of that. And Derek says, well, he said it didn't take place. You know, if you think about their experience with the press, particularly in 66, to read stuff like that, they've been through it so many times, they're beyond exasperated. Yeah, we know what the press are like. Again, very prescient.
Do you think it was Derek who leaked it? Because it's clearly something that happened behind closed doors. There's this film crew. So somebody in the film crew must have leaked it if it wasn't Derek himself stirring up a bit of extra publicity and press, keeping them in the papers. Looks a little sheepish sitting there in the corner.
He does. So do you think it's Derek?
Gosh. Yeah, that would be a good twist, wouldn't it? That could be an extra little plot line.
Wouldn't it?
Peter could have had.
I don't think he'd dare. I mean, crikey. Oof. No. Going up against one Beatle would be, like, difficult, but going up against all four of them and linking something like that, Ooh.
You wouldn't survive it.
No, not at all.
Oh, also side.
And he did say though that he read it before all of the riddles got put in, which I thought was a bizarre thing to say. Unless it had been, he'd approved an article that looked completely different, and then between him seeing it and it going to press, just somebody decided to spice it up a little
quite
bit.
Potentially.
Yeah.
That makes more sense, I think. Yeah.
Because he did look quite, he looked quite shocked, to be fair, at what had been said, because he was quite firm saying, no, he said it didn't take place. And then when John was like, no, Derek did look a bit like, oh.
So and, he's both shocked and sheepish.
Yes.
Which is a really difficult expression to pull.
Shocked and stunned.
It is very stunned.
My very incisive note at this point is that John has finally washed his hair.
Yes.
It's lovely and fluffy as opposed to all greasy and matted like it is in the previous days.
Yes, we were all pleased with that.
Well, it gets very hot under those lights, doesn't it?
It does.
I was going to say, one for Heather. Ringo at one point says, did you see Hancock last night?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure I saw, I don't even know if it was one of your tweets, Chris, that according to the television schedule, it would have been an episode called The Lift. They all get stuck in a lift. Which is a really, really good episode of Hancock.
Oh, give us a quick posy, because I want to know what John watched.
Oh, well, basically, they all get stuck in a lift. Tony.
Okay, thanks.
Tony tries to keep everybody entertained, fails miserably. And, do you know, it's years since I've seen the episode. I can't really remember, but I know it's really funny.
It was somebody on Twitter.
Yeah, that was nice.
Did the research, nice. I can't remember who it was. But shout out to whoever.
Whoever you are, thanks very much for all of that reading and the Radio Times you did.
Oh, I do. I genuinely do love stuff like that.
Yeah.
Derek kind of changes the subjects and he shows the photo. Now, you probably got better eyesight than me, but it looks like George is wearing a hat embroidered with sausages.
Yeah, or corks. I was wondering if it was bottled, like wine bottle corks.
Oh, is it corks?
Yeah. But not like the dangly Australian type. They're all around the rim, aren't they? Like end to end, which is very odd.
Yeah, I couldn't make out what they were.
He looks happy, though.
Like Bob Mortimer's What's It's hat.
Yes. George Harrison, the same one.
Yes.
George Harrison's sausage hat. Michael Lindsay-Hogg, you know, he's also been editing the Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And this is the point where he asked John to record a link for
him. Yes.
John does a great job on this, I think.
Nobody's ever taken anything as seriously as John Lennon takes this seriously. Yeah. This is all he says now for the rest of the entire documentary. Yeah. And now, your host this evening, The Strolling Bones.
Ringo then does some Keith Moon drum twiddles as Yoko dances.
This is my favourite moment.
It is lovely. Then the juggling. John can't juggle.
No.
Neither can RS. And then John cuts his finger.
His poor rock and roll finger. Yeah. It's hurt.
Michael Lindsay-Hogg giving a Beatle a nickname. I mean... Yeah. The audacity.
A Beatle that already has a very famous nickname.
Well, yeah.
Because he wants to be better than everyone else. I don't have really that much against him. He's just a little bit annoying in this film. I'm sure now he's not, because when you're that age, it's easy to be annoying.
Oh, of course.
So I'm sure he's fine now.
Apologies to any listeners who are 28 years old.
I mean, I have been 28 years old. Let me tell you, I was annoying. Many might say I still am.
20 years later, let me tell you. Oh, frightless.
Yes, exactly. I have a very, very random note, even more random. But yeah, I was sort of, as we were going through, I was just sort of writing down random thoughts as well. I watched, this is how much Get Back was getting into my head throughout the weeks that I was watching. I watched it over several days. I didn't watch the whole thing in one go. But I watched the film... Assault on Precinct 13, which is a John Carpenter American thriller from the mid-set, I think 1976. And there's two female characters in it. It's all blokes, but at least two women in it. One wears a yellow jumper and one wears an orange jumper. So just all the way through, I was thinking, I'll play if you want me to play or I won't play at all. The film was seeping into my mind.
It happens. So after, you know, a lot of criticism... throughout the episodes, Paul arrives, but he's the one that's late today. Nobody says anything to him.
Can you imagine anybody daring to say anything to him? Well, you know.
John's reading out a newspaper article about George being due in court to answer assault charges. It's all going on for George at the moment.
Yeah, he's not even...
accused of assaulting a photographer last May as he and Beatle Ringo Starr left a nightclub. So that was been 68.
Mm.
And you think flower children in India, I can't picture them going to a nightclub. Did they really go to a nightclub?
Did they really assault a cameraman?
With the papers, you have to take everything with the entire salt cellar, not just a pinch. It could be entirely fabricated, couldn't it? Looking at George's scowl in some of these, you could imagine him having a pop at a photographer.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if George has just got one of those faces, though. It's not... Obviously, I'm not saying this with any kind of disrespect, because I love everything about George Harrison's face. But it is one of those faces, and I have a very similar face, where even when you just sat there thinking about, like, you know, bunny rabbits and unicorns and nice things and chocolate milkshakes, you always look like you're ready to kill somebody. George just sat there, minding his own business, never thought a bad thing against anybody, and we're like, oh my God, the grumpiest beetle to ever grump.
He's got a right glower.
Vicky Ryan was on before.
He has.
Yeah, he's got a right glower.
He looks furious.
He's noggin. Vicky Riley was on before, and she was sort of talking about the resting bitch face.
Oh, yes.
And she was saying, like, Ringo's got resting hangdog face.
He does, doesn't he?
Oh,
and
he has. You when just kind of want to sort of... him by the ears. Makes yeah. it a bit better.
And Dave worm him. Actually, where did he come from? Yes.
No, you don't need to do it. That's not how you care for your drummers, Chris. Honestly, I did write a book about this a few years ago, but I don't want to talk about that.
I'm so sorry, that was from a conversation I was having earlier with a friend about their dog. I digress. Right, so at this point, Glyn is still not ready, and the Beatles getting a bit miffed. They want him to sort out the PA. Then Mal turns up with Magic Alex's latest invention.
Oh, yes, good old Mal. We love Mal.
We love Mal. Mal is the best.
He is. And he's bought a bass and rhythm guitar with a swiveling neck. Which is Magic Alex's new invention. It's interesting here because John is still pretty invested in Magic Alex despite everything, but nobody else in the band, or Mal even, takes the piss out of it, doesn't he?
I think even John's kind of a bit see. Like, oh, hello, here we go.
But it's the strangest looking thing.
Yeah, could it possibly work? Could such a thing work? It'd be desperately impractical.
But, how? Could, of course it couldn't work.
I'm thinking about that. We'd need a lot of ball bearings.
What questions that?
Every time you swiveled it around, the strings would snap off. Yeah.
They would!
Well, they'd need to be...
I don't know a lot about guitars, admittedly. I am just a drummer groupie. This is that's all I know. But, yeah... That's not going to work. That's nonsense.
Well, the strings would need to go into something on ball bearings. Each one would need to have a ball bearing on it. It wouldn't be a lot of fun.
But as Mal Evans said at the time, how do you tune it? Aside from the fact that they snap off each time you twist it, ball bearings or not. I'm not convinced by your ball bearings argument, I have to be honest.
And he's also got a plank of wood, which is some other... prototype. Or I don't think Mal's picked that up as a joke. Yeah.
Sorry.
What did he say the plank of wood was? Did he say that was just the bass guitar or something? I can't remember.
It was a prototype. It was a prototype plank of wood.
Wait till you see what happens when you turn that one over.
Yeah. So there's lots of faffing around as Glyn sets up the PA. And then there's a brief snippet. This is fantastic. I love this. And it's just a few seconds of Gary U.S. Bond's 1961 hit New Orleans, which sounds brilliant.
Yes.
And if anybody doesn't remember this, fast forward to it. It's only a few seconds long, but it's unbelievably good.
I remember that there being a good bit of music at that point. I'm actually not familiar with that song, shamefully.
Oh, you'll know it. I'm not going to say it, but Google Gary U.S. Bond's New Orleans, you'll know. And then they're doing Queen of the Hop. Mm. And George is looking through a pile of albums that have been delivered.
Yeah, he seems to be the one of the Beatles who is the most enthusiastic about other musicians and other artists. And also when you listen to the full audio, so not just the Get Back film, but the whole thing, he just wants to talk about other people. He actually doesn't really care about what the Beatles are up to. He just wants to talk about the band. Mm. And, anyone that takes his fancy. And so, yeah, he's the fanboy out of the group.
I suppose John and Paul see them as rivals, but George being the third in the band, they're contemporaries to him, I suppose.
Potential future employers.
Well, yeah. Then we get a brief snippet of Gilly Gilly Awesome Fever, Katzenel and Bogan by the Sea.
And they can do it without stumbling.
Easy for you to say.
That's talent.
And then we've got Chuck Berry's 40 Days, plus Too Bad About Sorrows, which is another really old Lennon McCartney song. It's interesting to hear these sort of late 50s, 60s songs that they're writing.
Yeah.
Very clichéd, but very interesting.
They're cliché, but they're good. I mean, they're not rubbish. They stand up quite well. I mean, I was writing songs when I was a teenager, and they're terrible. They're unlistenably bad. I mean, I never turned out to be in the Beatles, so there is that. But they still actually stand up as being fairly polished naff pop songs. They still work
yes,
as
definitely.
Songs.
But if it was when they were teenagers, I mean, surely rock and roll was at that sort of a time that nothing in it was cliched.
So that's true.
It would just be retrospectively cliché.
Mm. Yeah, they were just writing contemporary pop.
Can we just point out that I used a big word?
Very well done. 10 points to you.
I'm here all week.
I was never that interested in listening to their jams of all these old rock and roll songs. They just sounded a bit unenthusiastic and a bit saggy and a bit floppy. But actually seeing them do it works so much better, I think. It suddenly fits. It seems to have a lot more energy and a lot more life to it, to have the visuals as well as just the audio.
Oh, yeah, certainly. As somebody else has pointed out, it's the equivalent of, you know, in between, right, we're going to do a song. It's them checking their emails or checking Twitter. They just play old rock and roll numbers. They're not really they don't do anything serious. It's just occasionally if they do one after 909. Oh, actually, that sounds, we might be able to do something with that. It's quite a creative faffing.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I really enjoyed watching them, which I was surprised about. I enjoyed watching the jams so much because I haven't ever gone out of my way to... there's a few on the anthology, and I was thinking, oh, yeah, it's those Mailman Give Me No More Blues and that sort of thing. I don't have much enthusiasm for that, but, yeah, seeing it's great.
Then Kevin Harrington arrives. He's got a list of songs that they have as potentials, which Paul reads out to the others. And there's a few, a few things here. So All I Want Is You, I've Got a Feeling, obviously, The Long and Winding Road, Bathroom Window, they're still considering at this point, Let It Be, Across the Universe, Get Back to Where You Once Belonged, Two of Us on Our Way Home, Maxwell Silverhammer, I Got a Feeling, Sunrise and I'm in Mine. And Sunrise, it's obvious it's called All Things Must
George
Pass.
George is a bit horrified,
isn't he?
What did you call my song? That's not the title.
Oh, Dave. I genuinely thought for a minute there that they were going to cover the Who song, Sunrise.
Oh, yeah.
The Who song.
Who's
that? Now, that would have been good.
Sunrise.
Yeah, three-part harmonies on there.
Yeah.
John doesn't recognise Sunrise. He thought they'd learnt a song while he was late. He just quickly learnt a song called Sunrise to the point where it'd be ready to put on an album, which is great. Dig a Pony, and again, that's played by Feedback. And at this point, the lyrics are Take a Skylight.
Yeah.
Which is quite nice.
Yeah.
But it's he changes it to Dog a Bony. It's a bit naughty.
A bit rude. Honestly,
and it's Paul does this as well, and I love stuff like this. John's saying it's got to be D's and B's. He knows the sound of the
I
words.
I noted that. He's really that he wants. Thinking about the syllables and the consonants and exactly how it sounds. So it's not just a series of nonsense words. He is actually considering how, like, the timbre of the words and the rhythm of the words. So it's fascinating to see. I mean, obviously, the big one is Paul composing Get Back out of the blue, but it's fascinating to see their songwriting process generally and how they do think about these things and think about the words and how each of them approach coming up with the words.
Yeah, it reminded me, going back to Hancock, there was a documentary I saw a few years ago where Galton and Simpson were being interviewed about comedy writing, and they chose for it as an example the line from The Blood Donor, a pint that's very nearly an armful. And they started off having a pint that's an armful, which was funny. And then they said, it's funny, but it's too fast. So they added a little bit more. And then it was the scientific uncertainty of that's very nearly an armful that made the joke. So there's an awful lot of that involved as well.
Yeah.
In the creative process, like it would have sounded okay, but certainly as a writer, you do know that you've got to have a particular rhythm and a particular sound to every single sentence that you come out with, because you don't want to waste your words. You want to have as much impact as you can from whatever it is that you put down. And obviously it must go double really for songwriting, because you've got fewer words and specific melody to play about with. So yeah, no, I thought that was really interesting. It was a really interesting bit in that conversation. Of course, it all happens around my favourite moment, where there is the unboxing of a fragile Leslie. Now, let me tell you, this is the most relatable moment of all, because I have to unbox my own fragile Leslie before every single episode.
True.
And then I have to sweep the battered bits back in at the end of the show when I've embarrassed him with fanaring all over the place. And when George wanted to add the line, Kaja Leslie, all I could think of was Adam. Adam going, please, sir, sir, can I have one to catch me, sir, please, sir? No, you can't.
I endorse all of that. I'm very fragile.
It's
and
true,
I revolve at high speed.
He does. You want to see him? It's great. Loads of fun.
So, yeah, the Leslie arrives, which is good news going forward. And then there's some tech issues. Glyn comes out and says, just forget it. So they go to lunch. But Ringo's got a medical at 3:30.
It's presumably it's for medical. The film, for the insurance for the filming, I would guess.
Oh, yes, of course.
To see that he's fit to work with Peter Sellers.
I just thought it was because he'd been really poorly a couple of days earlier.
Ah.
You know, in the last episode, you know when Peter Sellers turned up and he really did look really, really poorly. His little face was all white and his eyes were all red.
I think he was hungover.
And the poor little hair trembled under the weight of us. No, he looked really poorly.
Yeah, I think they often
look
poorly in the morning.
He was still feeling lousy.
Yeah, John, I think John looked particularly poorly some of these days.
They were all very, 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 very translucent.
Yes.
I was just going to say white, but to be fair, they were beyond white.
No.
They were a whiter shade of pale.
You know, it's like a room full of golems.
Probably where the song came from. They really did.
They're so thin and pale and sickly.
You just want to kind of like go in with a cake.
You do, so just toast. Eating toast. Eat something with a bit of substance to it, lads.
Eat some actual food.
I think
kids.
They have marmalade, don't they, on the toast? But that's still...
Oh, well then, if they've got marmalade, what are we even complaining about?
Yeah, it's like vitamin C right there.
Yeah, sorry.
I think you're right.
As you were, boys. Probably
there's a lovely little moment here where John and Yoko are looking at the cover of the Beggar's Banquet album, and I just love the way it's unceremoniously kind of cast aside. Mm. And Yoko puts her fags.
Yeah.
Matches
Yoko breaking up the Beatles by looking at a Rolling Stones album cover.
How dare she?
What she's doing.
How dare she?
Then it's got a quick jam through some covers. So we've got Arthur Crudup's Since My Baby Left Me, which John would later do. High Heel Sneakers, Hallelujah, I Love Her So, Milk Cow Blues. Got Paul on drums.
Mm.
And then Ringo picks up his Hofner bass in anger? I don't think so.
No, he's having a noodle.
You leave them drums alone.
Hey, Ringo.
Leave them drums alone. Yeah, I think Paul's drumming posture is very different from Ringo's. He leans forward a lot, whereas Ringo sits up straight. He has a nice straight back.
Yes.
But Paul leans right over the kit. I mean, I don't want to talk out of turn. Heather's the drumming connoisseur here, so I'm probably just talking nonsense.
Oh,
but that was my observation.
No, he does have a particularly odd posture.
Did you warm to Paul while he's playing the drums?
To be honest, the less that I need to see of or speak about Paul McCartney behind the drum kit, the better for me, frankly.
Heather's never been the biggest Paul McCartney fan.
I haven't, I've not. My cousin used to go to school with Paul McCartney. This is an actual true fact. I feel like I ought to dig it, to pull this one out here. They both went to the Liverpool Institute together. And the big story that, like, the whole family still laugh at our poor Jeff over is that one day they were all in the common room. They were about 15, 16. And Jeff was trying to study for his exams, and Paul was sat there playing on his guitar, and he was, doing Jeff's heading. And in the end, our Jeff gets up and goes over to him and goes, For God's sake, I'm trying to study here. If you don't just settle down and put that guitar down, McCartney, you're never going to get anywhere in this life if you don't just sit down and study. And Paul was just like, okay, Jeff.
Wow.
So, yep, that's how good
that's
my family is at figuring out what's going to happen in the future.
I make up for it. I am a big Paul McCartney fan, so I balance it out.
Yeah, it's true.
I think between the three of us, it's 75%.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, then Paul's... Oh, this is mega orcs, as kids say. Paul's reading out the Michael Hasko article.
Oh, yeah.
And I find it generally uncomfortable.
Yes.
Because it's basically about the Beatles splitting up, and they're all kind of playing their instruments. John's deliberately singing over Paul's.
Yes.
And it's really weird.
It is. Like, as I've previously... I've got a lot of time for Paul, but it reminds me of when somebody is doing a bit that isn't really funny in the first place, but they just keep doing it. And no one's really interested in hearing their bit, but it goes on for a long time. And yeah, like you say, John's desperately trying to sing over Paul so that he'll stop and just join in with the song or something. But he reads the entire article out in a silly voice.
The dogged determination.
Yeah, and he's talking about, you know, John's divorce and, you know, all the things in this article that are quite awkward and quite personal, sensitive subjects. And Paul's delivering them over the speakers in a comedy voice, and I'm like, no, Paul, this is getting awkward now. Actually, this is probably the one bit in the film I could have done without. That maybe have the first couple of minutes, but he keeps the entire thing in.
The whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suppose
my best
the
bit was where it was in the article. I will deliberately leave Ringo out of it because he has never developed an inclination towards the bizarre. So the journalist really said Richard Starkey has never done a thing wrong in his life.
Essentially.
It goes to Ringo, who's smiling, and you don't really know whether he's smiling like, oh, they think that I'm the nice one, or he's thinking, these idiots, they haven't got a clue.
Yeah,
I'm the most problematic.
You.
Also, going back to our poor old Jeff, another sentence. Their capacity to earn is largely tied up in their performances as a group. They'll stay together for the economic necessity. This guy really called it.
He did, yeah. Paul McCartney's essentially in
his
uppers
now. They all went bankrupt after splitting up. Oh, God. The only other note I made for this particular moment is, if reincarnation exists, I want to come back as the tea towel on Ringo's snare.
That sounds like you. Yeah, I think you'd have a great old time.
Yes. Anyway.
The only real complaint I had about the film, and it doesn't happen in the episode we're watching, and this is sort of goes back to this, the fact that we've seen Paul narrate this entire article at slightly painful length, is I'd rather have had less of that and more of the actual songs that we had on the album. Because what it tended to do is, like, this is the take of Get Back that appeared on the album, and then as soon as it says that, it'll cut away to them listening to it back in the control room. It's like, no! No, don't cut away. I've known this song for 40 years. I want to see what it looks like. I want to see all the new, like, all their expressions that go along with the nuances of the vocals and all the little things they're doing as it's happening. Don't cut away. No, come back.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that would be a lot better, I think.
That's the bit I found really frustrating. The acres of Beatles we've got in this film, like, and we can't, please give us just the, they could make it an actual, I think there's only a couple of songs that aren't filmed. I think maybe Across the Universe and possibly Maggie May, but you could actually just have the whole album run visually as it appears on record, but do it as a visual thing. I'd love to see that, just be able to watch the Let It Be album.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be bootleggers out there that can recreate that.
Yeah.
So at this point, I've got a feeling, and Glyn is ready to go, and then John does his, and now your host for this evening, The Bottles.
Good old John.
He's sticking with that. And it sounds great.
Yeah.
And there's something missing. It's like a keyboard. I don't know. You know, it's that kind of feeling. It still needs something. But it sounds infinitely better than what they were doing at Twickenham.
Actually, we get the shot that was in the trailer, the teaser trailer, of John and Ringo with their arms around each other, which is lovely. That's one of my favourite
bits. It's a beautiful moment. It's beautiful, they're beautiful, yeah. I love it.
Paul and George very much with their arms not around each other, by contrast as well.
George and Paul very, very much being in the same postcode. My two notes before your next note, because I've just kind of like put a few little notes in between the thing that you sent to us. George is drinking the weakest cup of tea ever made. Southerners could not make a decent cup of tea. This looks like hot water with milk and the vague whisper of a tea bag that's still in the box in the next room. No wonder they have to drink so flipping much of it just to get a decent brew out. Piggin' hell.
They should have had you down there.
They should have had me down there. I make a great cup of tea. Oh, honestly.
I don't even like tea, and Heather makes a great cup of tea.
See, they could have had me. Just actually using a tea bag. That helps.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. And then another great thing that I thought was great, but I know that, like, this is just a Scouse thing. John calling Ringo Scabhead. It's like, it's such an old school Scouse nickname. Like, if you've not been called Scabhead by one of your best mates, then you're not allowed to call yourself Scouse. But Scabhead is just a thing.
Oh, lovely.
And it's a nickname I hadn't even heard in years, but as soon as John said it, I was like, ah, I got so nostalgic. And like, because I was watching when I first saw it, I was at home, and I live just outside Stockport. But when I heard him say, I just felt so, so, so homesick.
Oh.
And I ended up I've ended up coming back to Merseyside, like, the day after, I think. I was like, nah, I need to go back.
Yeah, oh, it's lovely. So then we get to hear I Dig a Pygmy by Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids. And again, it's one of those things we've known all our lives, but it's there.
Yeah,
he's just
saying it with his mouth. John. It's astounding. Yeah.
As opposed to
just
what?
One of the many random things he says throughout the day.
And then they're doing, I Dig a Pony. And he's still messing around with the lyrics. And he does this amazing, insane laugh where he's going, after we got to Wind Love, I went berserk. And he does this, it's like something from a horror film. Look out for it. Yeah, then they changes it to Blue a Roadhog. Yeah, they're playing together. So Paul's saying, slither wildly like a blind dog.
As it creeps away across my underpants.
Yeah. Richard Rodgers has got nothing on this.
I do feel like George Flummock seems to be George's entire mood.
I think that's Michael Lindsay Hogg, isn't it? Why did I agree to do this?
One thing I've picked up from watching this, actually, is that there's three of the Beatles have a very kind of hyperactive and will just mug at camera and just do anything to entertain everyone. And just little George is standing there playing his guitar and wanting to get on with it. The other three are like, anytime they see a camera, they pull faces and do a dance or sing funny lyrics and lark about or do juggling. And there's George just playing me guitar. Very different energy levels.
Yeah. And Ringo's just a solid rock, isn't he, all the way through?
Yeah.
He just puts up. With all of this amazing stuff going on around him, just carries on 4/4 beat.
Mm.
He does make me laugh.
I say he's a machine.
Oh, yes.
He is.
Yeah.
Ringotron.
Ringotron 7000.
And the final session ends with Madman, I've Got a Feeling, Don't Let Me Down, with the Dickie Murdoch line.
Oh, yeah. Dickie, Dickie, Do.
I don't know why. She came in through the bathroom window and John's on Rhodes' piano. And there's a little moment where he flashes his top off for the camera.
Oh, yeah.
Paul's talking to him, but he's kind of playing up to the camera behind him.
So we can see his ribs and how few cakes he's eaten recently.
Paul Love.
Almost translucent.
He is. Yeah, you can almost see Paul through him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pulling a face.
Yeah, and I've just got a little thing here, the three-part harmony on. Didn't anybody tell her?
Mm.
It's very beautiful. Again, Peter Jackson, this is him being amazing. They discuss the need for a pianist, and he keeps planting all these seeds throughout the... I'm sure it's the editing, I don't know if it's the order, but... And John's initial thing is, well, let's get Nicky Hopkins in. And George is like, we just need one more in the group. That's what it is.
I wonder if it could be. Yoko then breaks up the Beatles by sitting quietly next to John while he's playing piano. She's probably admiring his stripy shirt because it makes him look like a little stick of Blackpool rock.
I thought it made him... How is that where he looks like a pack of refreshers? Or was that a different day?
No, that's the one.
Yes.
If she was a real fan, she'd be admiring Paul's scratchy orange jumper.
I wonder if that's the same jumper that he was wearing whilst berating George. I do like the second half a lot more once they're in the white room.
Yeah.
At Savile Row.
Yeah, everything's changed, hasn't it? The whole atmosphere. They're all completely up for it now.
Yeah, even George is having something of a nice time.
Oh,
there are moments when he's not thinking about joining the band. I'd be playing in the band now.
I think he wanted the Beatles to become the band.
I think so. There's a bit well. Peter Jackson cuts out all mention of the band, but there's a bit right at the beginning where he compliments Paul's beard and says, "Oh, your beard really suits you." And in the full audio, he says, "You look like Rick Danko."
Mm.
So just any excuse to fangirl over the band. Yeah. He takes it. He's just throughout. He's just like, "Oh, yeah, this one. This sounds like this song we're doing. That sounds like the band. Have you noticed? This sounds like the band." He's just a bit obsessed by them, which is rather sweet.
Nothing wrong with a good fangirl.
Probably why they're getting so annoyed with him. Just shut up about the band. We know. So Heather and Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been the first
day.
Thanks
very much for inviting us.
Oh, thank you. Imagine for a moment, each of you, that you are Michael Lindsay Hogg.
I'm just contemplating cigars.
Okay.
Yes, same.
How would you feel at the end of today, first day back at Savile Row?
Well, I think Ringo's shirt went along well.
Well, if I was me but I was Michael Lindsay Hogg, I would be relieved that people seem to be enjoying themselves more and the music seems to have picked up and just the energy levels seem to have picked up and it all feels much more positive and joyous. But that's me as Michael Lindsay Hogg. But I think Michael Lindsay Hogg as Michael Lindsay Hogg might be a bit disappointed that there isn't quite so much strife and misery. Having watched his... and it's been probably 15 to 20 years since I've seen Let It Be on scratchy VHS video from a dodgy dealer at a record fair in Middlesbrough.
So specific.
Yeah, it's not really a fun film. And I remember watching Let It Be, thinking, where's John? Like, one thing you know about John is he sees a camera and he larks about and he tries to make people laugh. But clearly he was having such a bad time in these sessions that he wasn't. But actually he was. So really, most of the joy he's taken out of these, he's edited it so it's a more entirely joyless experience. So I think the real Michael Lindsay Hogg would be a bit disappointed that things are now going quite well.
They're all getting on together too well now. We can't have them being friends. No. I'm gonna tell Paul what George says he smells.
He's busy outside. He's outside, busy looking for a stick he can poke into somebody's spokes on the way past.
And that's what happened to Magic Alex's face.
Heather Wainwright and Adam Leslie, thank you so much. It's
thank
been brilliant.
You. It has. It's been lovely.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris Shaw. Hey!